welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is film composer Richard Gibbs. First of all, let's talk about financing in the music industry, which has changed a whole lot in the last year. Now, when I talk about financing, I'm talking about financing for projects and also investment in the music business. And there hasn't been a lot for 3 or 4, maybe 5 years. The reason why was that all the investment money went to online distribution networks, the Spotify's of the world, the streaming music entities of the world. But that all kind of dried up, especially for new startups. And the reason why is that it became so expensive for licensing because you had to go to all the major record labels and get a new license. And this became so expensive that most investors were kind of scared away. That's all changed in the last couple years. First of all, crowdfunding came about, and obviously that's more than a couple years old, but that was a transition into today's financing. All sorts of artists, songwriters, bands began to use this as a way to finance their projects or tours. And in some cases, it was fairly successful. As a matter of fact, music is one of the most successful crowdfunding ventures that you have in that particular space. More than 50% of the crowdfunding campaigns are actually successful. So it's one of the more successful things that you can do online. That being said, really big money is coming into the space. And what I mean by big money, I'm talking about big hedge funds and institutional investors that now want to get into the music business. Why? Well, first of all, the music business doesn't correlate with the stock market. The reason why is royalties are fairly consistent cash flow as compared to the up and downs of the market. The second thing is the music industry is clearly rebounding and everybody wants to get in on that. And then thirdly, royalty collection is now becoming more and more efficient, where once upon a time you had to wait 6 months, a year, even 2 years to get some foreign royalties in. Now it's becoming very quick and coming in on a monthly basis in many cases. So the institutional investors and the hedge funds and big private investors now want to get a piece of the music business. And it's happening in a couple of different ways. And just to give you an example, there are two companies that are facilitating this. One is called the Royalty Exchange. And this is an exchange where you can buy and sell royalties. So in other words, if I'm a successful artist and I know there's royalties coming in, and I think they're going to be coming in for the next 5 years or so, but I want cash up front, I can go and sell a portion of these royalties or all the royalties if I want to. And then on the other hand, there's entities that want to buy these royalties or pieces of royalties. And there's an auction that actually occurs for this to happen. So it can be bid up beyond the initial asking price. So that's very cool. A few years ago, we never would have thought something like this would happen, and now it's becoming reality. On the live side, there's actually a site called LiveAmp. And this finances tour production, and it finances things like music videos and even album projects. Once again, the investor takes a share of the future profits for this. Now, you might think, oh, well, that's well and good, but I have my little band here, or I'm an artist, I'm just starting up, how do I get a piece of it? Well, guess what? Unless you already have some success and are looking at a fairly steady royalty stream, this isn't for you. So if you have any kind of success and you want to get some money up front, this is the way to do it because there are investors out there that now want a piece of your royalties. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyownercircle.com. The 4th editions of my Mixing Engineer's Handbook, the Recording Engineer's Handbook, and Mastering Engineer's Handbook are now available on Amazon and soon coming to a bookstore near you. You can read excerpts and find out more details by going to bobbyosinski.com. The next thing I want to talk about is do-it-yourself audio kits. When I was growing up, and a lot of my listeners when you guys were growing up as well, there were lots of kits available from companies like Heathkit and Ico and Allied Radio and Dynaco, where you can actually build your own audio or hi-fi gear. And a lot of us learned electronics by doing that. Those companies are now out of business, And one of the reasons why is there became a liability problem with kits. So in other words, if someone burned themselves or got a bad shock, electrocuted themselves from a kit that a company made, they were liable for the problem. And that forced many companies out of the business, and it even forced modern companies out of the business as well. There's a well-known microphone company that actually started as a kit company and stopped and transitioned into being a regular mic company because of this liability problem. They were going to be successful. Everything pointed to many people wanting their products. But once again, if you're afraid of getting sued, that kind of puts the brakes on everything. That being said, right now, there are more and more companies that are providing audio kits than ever before. I just did a little research on this for my Recording Engineer's Handbook, and I was kind of amazed. First of all, on the microphone side, there's a company called Microphone Parts, and that's microphone-parts.com online. And they have kits for various types of microphones, and not only that, they have upgrade kits as well for nearly any kind of mic that you might have. So even if you have a fairly inexpensive Chinese condenser microphone, chances are they have a kit to upgrade that, and it will make a big difference. So that's one of the very, very cool companies that you can build your own mics if you want. There are also lots of companies that now provide preamp and EQ and compressor, summing amps, DIs, 500 series modules, power supplies, discrete op amps, and even parts for you to build your own audio device. More than ever before, and more kits that can build you clones of the much lauded devices that we really love, or some things that are brand new. Some of those companies include 7 Circle Audio, and that's 7circleaudio.com, 5 Fish Audio, which is 5fishstudios.com, DIYRE, or Do-It-Yourself Recording Equipment Company, that's all one word, .com, Hairball Audio, sounds like a funny name, but they make some really cool stuff, hairballaudio.com, JLM Audio, jlmaudio.com, Sound Sculptor with the K, and Classic Audio Products, which is capi-gear.com. Truly, this is a golden age for audio kits, and I can tell you, if it were 20 years ago, I would probably have a studio filled with these things, because I've heard nothing but good things from everybody who's done this. Now, this is a great way to get your electronics chops together. There's nothing like learning soldering, and there's nothing like learning about discrete electronics by actually doing it yourself. So I highly encourage you, if you haven't done this before, now is the time, because you can make a great device for not a whole lot of money. It's definitely worth your time. Richard Gibbs is a longtime LA session musician who transitioned into composing for film and television. He's since gone on to score more than 60 films. Rich is also a longtime friend who I love having on the podcast, because he always has such great stories. He was previously on episode number 38 a couple of years ago, so I thought it was time to get him back in again. This time we spoke strictly about the art and business of film composition, but the conversation was so engaging that we also recorded part two. And part two is just about his unique, one-of-a-kind studio. I spoke with Richard via Skype from his studio in Malibu. In your wide experience as a film composer, and in time that you've been a film composer, what has changed? I mean, what's the difference today than when you first started?
Well, first off, I'm older, so that changed. It's a continuum of change. I came into the industry at a time of change, and there was a big transition then from working with film to working with video, and then working with computers, and technologically has changed, dramatically, and continues to morph. And that has also affected the, not just the workflow of the composer, but also the, even to the politics, the business politics of how one goes about making music for movies and television shows.
What does that mean exactly?
Well, for instance, what's happened is that when I first came on the scene as a composer, the editors were still working with film. And what that meant was that it was a more laborious process to edit. And that forced editors and directors and producers to really think about what they were doing before they started cutting the film. It took longer to do it, so therefore you thought it through ahead of time more. And once they had achieved an edit that they liked, that worked, and that everybody agreed upon, that was then deemed a locked reel or a locked film. Meaning, we aren't going to open it back up again, we aren't going to start editing any further, it's done, and now we can turn it over to the composer to get to work, because the composer, the timings are, of course, crucial when you're scoring to picture. And just, you know, even the tiniest edit can radically affect the effect of a of a piece of music to film. So you get what was called a locked picture, and the editor and others would basically go away for a few weeks while the composer did his or her job. And then you go forward from there. Well, now, because how technology has affected that process is people don't work any longer on film. When they're edited, editors don't work with film. They work on a computer. Even if it was shot on film, they still will input everything into a computer, and all the edits are done with an Avid system or Final Cut Pro or any number of other programs. The point is, it's all in a computer. So now they can do non-destructive editing on a whim, and they do on a whim. And now they don't have to make up their mind until basically they turn over the reels at the very end of the process, just right at the dubbing stage. So that means the composer now is constantly adjusting to changes that are being made by the editor and the director and the producers, and maybe responses to, in response to audience test screenings and so on. And that has radically affected the mechanics of film scoring, but it's also affected the politics of film scoring, because now everybody has an opinion. Everybody gets involved because it's so technologically easy to change the tenor of a film in the editing process. It can happen so quickly that now everybody's invited to be part of the process more. And I think it's to the detriment of the quality of the outcome.
I mean, it sounds like it would be. Whenever you begin to get more people involved, the creative spark seems to go out of things. And I haven't done much on the movie scene, but I can remember I was mixing the music for, I can't remember what the movie was, and I had the director and a couple of the producers in the room with me the whole entire time, as well as the composer, and that wasn't bad. I mean, it was only four or five people, but it was a lot more than I was used to, and everybody had an input on it, so it didn't make it easier, that's for sure.
No, and now, in that... That's actually kind of normal compared to what I'm talking about now. Now what's happened, let's start extrapolating from there. Now, because everything, it can be done in files, everything is reduced to a file. It also used to be, if somebody wanted to hear the music that I was writing while I'm in process, that would, 9 times out of 10, mean the director alone would come out to my studio and sit with me while I would either play it on the piano or later on play mock-ups that were done with samples and so on of what the orchestra would do. Or maybe it's a synth score and then they'd hear closer to what the final version is going to be. Whatever it is, the director would come out and hear it. Well, something else happened somewhere along the line. This internet thing became much more facile and easier to work, and people started saying, well, I want to hear it, send me the files. And now there are people all along the line in the production process who want to hear what the composer is doing. And as typically as I finish a cue, a piece of music, people want me to send out that file of that piece of music. And it gets sent to, it can be anywhere from 2 to 20 people.
Wow.
And they all have an opinion. And they're all coming into it from a different perspective. And there'll be people that I haven't even met that are offering opinions of what the music should be now, and it's completely out of context. So this is what I'm talking about when I say that it has radically affected the politics of the making of music for film. And it's not been a positive result by and large. I mean, it may be a positive result for that particular producer who feels like, oh, now I get to have say in my movie. That's fine for them, but the piece of art itself suffers because now everybody has a say and they weigh in at different points in time. It's become this wild landscape of faceless committees.
That means you're editing right up to the time of your deadline then.
Years ago, yes. Years ago, that term I used called locked picture, which is destined to go on to, become a historical term. Somewhere along the line, I started hearing people calling it a latched picture, which I thought was hilarious.
Wow.
Meaning the door is shut, but they can open it back up,
yeah.
And they might. And now even that's just gone. The whole concept of locked picture is gone. People will say to me sometimes, oh, we're done. It's locked. But I never believe it. And yeah, edits will happen. Actually, plenty of times now I've seen edits happening on the dubbing stage. While they're putting the dialogue, the effects, the music, they're still editing the picture on the stage. I've seen that happen. Which, of course, to a composer is horrifying because the amount of work that you put in to hit all those timings and hit that mood. So it's not from a selfish point of view, it's not a good thing because it makes for more work. But from the artistic point of view, I think it's not a good thing, too. Of course, occasionally it's nice from the director's point of view to retain control and be able to make changes all the way through to the end. I get the advantages of it, too. But by and large, I don't think it's a good thing.
Does that mean that you have to go to the dubbing stage now?
Well, actually, contractually, I've always had this, at least in my contracts, that if the director or producers requested my presence, that I had to come. And I think that's pretty common. Now, that's not to say that they want me to come. It's just that they can request my presence. I usually would go to the dubbing stage on most pictures I work on. I would go at some point, but I wouldn't hang out. I would go for playbacks when they finished. I don't want to sit there and listen while they're adjusting the level of a tire squeal or something.
Yeah.
It's an incredibly painstaking and tedious process, as you know, and not that much of it has to do with the music. They're dealing with effects and dialogue and the like. So it is most composers, certainly I don't just hang out day in and day out while the dubbing process is going on, but I will come in and check in for playbacks to see how things are going and see if there's any suggestions that I might have how to make it better.
Okay, so you told me about how technology has been to the detriment of the composer. Has it been to the advantage of the composer?
Not to me. Not for me. And it's kind of a funny thing for me to say because, I mean, my background, I have kind of the two parts of my background that are a little bit at odds in a way. I'm a classically trained composer, so I can think with just pencil and paper, and I can write and I can get down what I want to get down, and I can hear what the sound of a clarinet is in my head when I'm creating a piece of music. I know what I want. But I'm also a synthesist, and that was part of my background as a player, as a session player, I was the guy that would come in and program sounds and then play them for other people, for other composers on records or whatever it might be. So I don't have the need of those mock-ups, let me put it that way, that some other people might. Somebody that doesn't have the classical training that I have will find it advantageous to be able to sit down and when they come up with a melody to try different orchestrations out. So there are advantages to it. There are massive advantages to it. I don't particularly enjoy those advantages, but I understand it.
With music schools everywhere now having film composition programs, it seems like there's more competition than ever to do what you're doing. So if that's the case, how is that affecting you or people like you who've been in the business for a while? And also, how does it affect people trying to get into the business?
Well, obviously, it's not a good thing from my personal perspective to have more competition. It's like if you're a plumber, you don't want 20 more plumbers that live in your city. I certainly don't begrudge anybody that wants to get into the business, and I'm supportive of young composers all the time. I try to help them out. I started the Composer Breakfast Club in Malibu as part of that. But it's the downside more than anything else. I don't mind the competition. Competition's healthy. The downside is what's happened, though, is, and this is only part of the reason, is the competition is only part of the reason, is that the cost, the price, the value of film score has plummeted over the last 5 or 10 years. And that's for a host of reasons. This is only part of it. And that's not good for anybody. So it's not as lucrative a career as it used to be. And at the same time, it's not as fun as it used to be in terms of the creative aspect of it. So I feel like I kind of came on the scene as a composer at a particularly golden time. But then again, I would imagine that if Elmer Bernstein were still with us and you ask him the question, he would say he came on the film scoring scene in a particularly golden time, before the advent of computers and before the advent of video even. It was a whole different process back then. So, maybe the guys that are in their 20s now and scoring and dealing with things that I find to be inconvenient, maybe they see this as a golden time because they don't know any better. I don't know. That time will tell that. I don't think it's a good thing what's going on right now. I think that to focus on your question, I think there are far too many film composers being churned out by the schools. The market is definitely saturated with film composers.
Well, it's the same for engineering and production students. It's musicians. It's pretty much across the board in the entertainment business where it's too easy. I shouldn't say this, but it's very easy to get the education that it makes you think that you don't need the experience, and the experience is a vital part of what we all do. And so, there's the element of paying your dues and paying it for a while that I think is, if it's not eliminated, at least the thought of I have to pay my dues is eliminated. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I mean, or to put an even finer point on it is, Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hour theory. You've got to have those 10,000 hours in there, and school doesn't count as 10,000 hours. You need to put in that time. It's not just paying dues in the aspect of, like some kind of a hazing process. It's more than that. It's the experience. What do you do in this situation? Well, I've been there before, so I know how to deal with this adroitly. That's, there's a lot to be said for experience. And there's, the there's a reason that the old Lions are good at what they do, because they've done it. They've done those 10,000 hours plus. They've done hundreds of thousands of hours sometimes, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, there are advantages to that, and they're just, you know, you get guys that come out of school and they've had all the training. They know how to run Pro Tools. They know how to stack up a minor seventh chord and put a ninth on top, but that doesn't mean they understand how to tell a story with music. That's not something that can really be taught. That's something you have to do through trial and error over and over and over.
On the other hand, let me just play the devil's advocate for a second, and I agree with you, but there's a lot of people our age that are teaching and are teaching
That's
some
right.
of those finer points in colleges, and we both know a number of them. And if you get those teachers as a mentor, even though it might be in school, it's not quite the same thing, at least you have a head start, I would think.
It's kind of like looking at a picture of something. You can look at pictures of surfing, but it's totally different than being out there paddling out through the waves and dealing with the elements. I can tell you what it's like to surf. I can describe it to you the best way I can. I can show you video, but it's a totally different experience when that wave first hits you and you're paddling out and it sends you tumbling backwards toward the rocks. So
yeah,
that's the only time you learn. You have to learn on the job. Everything else is preparation for learning, but that's not learning.
I have a closed Facebook group for my 101 Mixing Tricks course. And someone asked yesterday, saying, I can't figure out how to do mixing, and I understand all the technical parts, but for some reason I'm not hearing it right. And the reason why was the person was nowhere near a major studio where he could get his reference point. Because, you know, once you hear something that sounds great, it never leaves you. There's your reference point. You understand what you're going for. But if you never hear that, then it's constant trial and error to get there, and it takes a long time. And that's the same thing that you're saying, you know, until you actually get your reference point and you're in that environment, it's trial and error.
Yeah, and if you're not in the environment, you don't even know when you've made an error. You may not know because you don't get that feedback loop. You don't get that producer saying, oh, you're an idiot. Or you don't hear the violinist trying to play something that's out of range. You don't get your orchestrator telling you, no, don't balance it like that. You can't have five trumpets against 20 strings. The strings won't be heard. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of examples of that. And going to your engineering point, it made me think of something. We have, I own a recording studio. I know that's another podcast, which I'm happy to do at any time. And the recording studio, we get a lot of great clients here and a lot of great engineers that come through here. And a huge artist who will remain nameless was in here, and she had brought, well, there I just eliminated 50% of the artists. But she had brought in her normal engineer, who was a highly respected, really good engineer, but then her producer was bringing his own engineer as well. And I was talking to the artist engineer, and I said, oh, who's the other engineer that's coming in? And he said, oh, well, he's a pretengineer. And I loved that term, and it stuck in my head, and I just kind of laughed. I go, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, he's one of these guys that has spent, he's learned how to engineer by using a laptop, and he can edit. Basically, he started in GarageBand and worked his way up through Pro Tools and so on. But if you put him in front of a patch bay or a drum kit that needs miking, he doesn't have a clue. He has no idea what signal path even means, and doesn't know how to do that. He just does laptop engineering, and to this guy, he called that a pretengineer. I wish there was a clever composer version of that, you know, some other play on words for a composer. Maybe somebody will come up with it and let me know. But the closest thing I can come to it is an old term where they called composers that really didn't know what they were doing. They were called hummers.
It makes sense, though. Yeah, right.
And there are composers, so I can name, and I won't, who are very talented, who are very good at what they do, but they are hummers. They don't know how. In other words, a hummer is let's get out of the sexual meaning of the term. Some of you may be thinking that are listening to this. A hummer is somebody who is musically illiterate and doesn't know how to write down, but they hear melody, they hear what they want, and they have to turn to somebody else who is musically literate to transcribe that for them, and they hum that melody, or they thump out the drum part. That's a hummer.
You know, I have a story kind of revolving around that. In the 80s, when I first came to Los Angeles, I don't know how it happened, but I befriended a guy who owned a recording studio in Seattle, and he was originally from Alaska, or he was part Alaskan. And it so happened that particular year, anybody who had Alaskan heritage had a windfall from the oil profits.
Uh-huh.
And he got a lot of money. A lot of money. And
they invested into a recording studio.
Well, that was part of it, but actually on the film side, all of a sudden, he was befriended by a number of film studio heads who all wanted in on the deal, and one in particular offered him a 4-picture deal as a composer.
Okay.
And this guy was a little bit of a musician. I mean, he could play and everything, but really he couldn't read or write, so he would probably fall under the categorization of a hummer. And he didn't take the deal. I don't think that was a big enough carrot for him. So he wound up keeping some of his money at least and not having that. But there you go. It just goes to show you how those things happen, where we could have had somebody on the scene that, or another person on the scene that was somewhat illiterate in how to do things and yet getting some big movies.
Well, it's amazing to me how little people, filmmakers, and by filmmakers I mean it in the broadest sense, I'm talking producers, screenwriters, directors even, who do not understand the film scoring process at all. Most people that are directors have gone through some kind of film school and have studied how to interact with actors. They've studied cameras, camera placement, lighting. They've studied editing. But rarely do they study how music works with film. Even from an artistic standpoint, let alone the technical standpoint. So therefore, it's kind of this, kind of a black art. And they end up hiring, composers are hired all the time for the wrong reason, all the time. The wrong composer is put on the wrong project. And because the people hiring them don't understand how to select a composer. And it's, you know, it's endemic. And it remains endemic within the industry. And that's a big reason why composers are often replaced on films. It happens all the time.
How often does that happen, do you think?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that answer is out there. I've seen there are people who have compiled examples of film score replacement. And I'm just talking about film. I'm not even getting into television or video games or anything else. I've scored somewhere in the neighborhood of 60, 65 films, somewhere in there. And depends on how you count it. I have probably been replaced myself 5 times, and I've replaced other people 6 times, somewhere in there. And so that's, you know, and I think I'm probably pretty average terms of that. I don't take umbrage when I get replaced, because it happens to the best of us. Jerry Goldsmith got replaced.
Wow.
People, it happens. So, And quite often for the wrong reason. I'll give one example. I was, especially early in my career, I had quite a few jobs as the replacement composer. I was brought in to fix a score or just completely, usually just replace an existing score. And there was one project in particular where I was brought in. I knew who the composer was who had scored the movie. I didn't know him personally, but I knew he was at the very least a competent composer, certainly very much my senior, much more experience under his belt, and I had nothing but respect for the guy. And they asked me, said, "We're not happy with the score, we want you to replace it." And I said, "Well, I'm flattered, and sure, I'd love to, but first I have to ask you, have you voiced your complaints to the composer that you have? Have you told them what you want that's different?" Because what they wanted was the producers to come in and were not happy with the score. And had actually called me from the scoring stage. And this sounds like a scene from a movie. They're talking to me from the scoring stage. I could hear the orchestra in the background. And they're calling me and saying, "We want to replace the score."
Wow.
And I just put myself in that guy's shoes. He's out there conducting an orchestra. And while he's conducting, they're replacing the guy.
Huh.
And I went in the next morning and met with these producers. And they were actually bypassing their director. The director had directed this composer to give the score that he thought was correct for the movie. The producers disagreed with the director, thought he was out to lunch with his ideas, which, by the way, I agreed with the producers creatively.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't agree with them in terms of how they dealt with it. I suggested to them, I said, "Well, have you talked to the composer and or the director to get what you want?" And they didn't want to do that. And they just said, "Look, if you won't do it, we're going to hire somebody else who will."
Hmm.
"So don't think you're doing this composer any favors by turning it down. We'd like you to do it. Will you do it?" And I said, "All right, well, you put it that way. Okay, I'm on." And then they told me it was a condition of me taking the job that I was not to speak with the director of the movie.
How do you do that?
Well, I didn't. Ultimately, I mean, I start to work on the movie. I just did my own spotting session. You know, I sat down and figured, well, this is where I want music. This is what I think it should be. I'm telling the producers, and they were kind of, "Yeah, whatever you think. We just like what you do, so do what you think." And about halfway through the scoring process, the writing process, I get a call from the director. He had found out about my existence on this project and had been, was kind of horrified about the whole thing, was not mad at me at all, just said, he called me up and said, "Look, I know I'm not supposed to call you. I've been told that I don't have any input on this." And he was completely browbeaten. I felt horrible for the guy. He said, "I just want to know, can I just come over and hear what you're doing just so I can hear it?" And it was so sad, right?
Yeah.
So I said, let me get back to you, I feel for you. And I immediately called my agent and asked him, "How do I deal with this one?"
Yeah.
And he said, "Well, I guess be straight ahead, you know." And so I called the producers and told them, I said, "Well, this guy tracked me down. He knows what I'm doing. He knows about this whole thing. What would you like me to do?" They said, "Well, what do you think?" And I said, as a human being, I feel bad for this guy that he spent all this time, you know, a year making a movie, and suddenly he's cut out of the process. I would be open to having him come over if it's okay with you. And they said, "Sure, but if you disagree with anything he says, don't do it. We're putting our faith in you, and you know, if he gives you any direction in any way, shape, or form you don't like it, you are to ignore it." I said, "Okay, that's a new one."
no for kidding.
Me, he was the director.
Yeah.
So the guy came over, and he was such a sweetheart. He liked what I was doing. He definitely kind of was caught by surprise a little bit that it was a completely different direction, and yet it worked, and it put a different spin on his movie. It was a complete change in direction. And, I mean, it was not subtle. Orchestration, style, spotting, everything, just outlook from the get-go. I saw the movie as a different movie than the director did. And then when he saw it, and then he saw what I was doing, heard what I was doing, and looking at it with me. And I watched his eyes kind of light up. Oh, this is cool. I hadn't thought about it like this. That's really cool. And it was fine. There were no problems whatsoever, which told me something, that those producers had not really bothered to have that conversation. They had not really, had that creative conversation that should have been had. And maybe they would have gotten what they wanted with that original composer. Yeah. It goes back to that. So it was a sad situation. Ultimately, it was not a movie that made a ton of money, and most people never even heard of it. So that was that.
Wow, what an experience, though. Gee.
I can give you 10 more like that, different spins on that. And getting back to that technological question of how that affects the politics of a movie, this is one that I will name and people will know, was Battlestar Galactica, not a feature film. It was a TV show. When I scored the original, it was a 4-hour miniseries, and that went very well. And it was a lot of work, but everything was great. But then they decided it was very successful. It was what they call a backdoor pilot. It wasn't really set up as a pilot. It was set up as a miniseries. But the idea was, if it succeeds, everybody knew that they were going to relaunch it as a series. And it was successful. They did relaunch as a series. Now they needed a theme, opening title theme, a traditional, a piece of music to start the whole thing. But without going into all the machinations of the whole thing, now everybody was involved, and everybody wants clips, and everybody wants to see what that's going to be. And by everybody, again, I mean people I had never met, I didn't even know their names, were offering opinions, and driving the director, our friend, Michael Reimer, crazy. But we stuck through it. I ended up writing that opening title music for Battlestar Galactica. I did 17 versions of that.
Wow.
Because of all the different input. Now, in that case, I'm happy with the end result. I think it came out great. But I also liked version one.
Yeah.
I liked it from the get-go. I never allowed it to be something I didn't like. I won't do that as a composer. I won't write something I don't like. And after it was all done, after everybody had signed off on it, and it was a litany of people that needed to sign off on it, and we're done. Months later, they started to broadcast the show, but they originally started to broadcast the show in England. I think it was England, and I'm not sure, a few other territories, before the Universal started broadcasting it in the United States. Well, technology being what it is now, or even then, people were anxious, sci-fi fans were anxious to hear what that was, so people were downloading it and watching the English version of the show, but they're watching it in America, right?
Yeah.
And somewhere along the line, Universal decided to really pay attention to this show, and this woman named Bonnie Hammer, who is the head of Universal, certainly as far as the television goes at the time, decided that the opening to the show was too somber, that it wasn't, it needed to be more heroic and more orchestral, and both musically and visually. Which was, in a way, music to my ears, because that was originally what I wanted to do, was to write kind of a traditional space opera, John Williams-esque opening, and which worked, but Michael had a different viewpoint, and then he brought me around to his viewpoint, and so on through 17 versions through all these producers and everybody else. We'd arrived at what we had, which I also liked, completely different take on it. Well, Bonnie Hammer didn't like that. And now this is done. It's out. It's already being broadcast, right?
Yeah.
So they had to go back in. They hired an editor. Bonnie hired an editor different than the editor that had been working on the show all along, Michael's editor, Danny Cooper, who was great. And they hired a different editor, somebody in New York that nobody had any contact with, and they re-edited the opening of the show and took this editor. I got a call from the line producer on the show saying they want you to rewrite the main title based on what this editor has edited together using some of the music from the show. I said, well, that's interesting. So I heard it. They sent it to me, and I said, well, this doesn't really work. There's no melody here. It's a piece of incidental music that was never meant to be thematic. There's nothing about it that's thematic. And I can see why the editor put it in there, because it was easy to edit to, but there's nothing musical about it. There's no theme. And but that's fine. I'll make it work. And it was a piece, by the way, that was written by a guy who had been my assistant, who I had turned over the episodic versions of the show to do. And he had written this one little piece, and they wanted to use that. Or the editor had used that. I said, well, let me rework it, and I'll do something with it. I hear where they're going with it. It's not a problem. And that's when I got this edict that just kind of floored me. He said, well, make it better, but only make it 10% better. They actually said this to me. What? You can only make it 10% better. In other words, do exactly what this is, and you can do a little bit more to it if you want that to make you happy, but this is what we want. And it musically was wrong. It was just wrong to me. It didn't feel right. And it was one of the few times in my life I said, well, I won't do that. I'm not going to do that. I think it's a mistake. And so I said, you go ahead and contact, you know, my former assistant, have him finish it up. So they did, and he did. And that was released in the United States as the main title. It was actually half my music, half his, kind of butchered together. And they talk about taking it to the, you know, how it's never done. This was hilarious to me. What ended up happening is that the fans of the show who had heard, there were many who had heard the original version, which they had dubbed, the fans dubbed the UK theme, and then the US theme, which was this bastardized version that was done for Bonnie Hammer. Those fans started protesting when they heard the new theme, said, no, this is not as good. So after the first season, they reverted in the US back to the original UK theme.
Wow.
So the fans get their final say. They overrode, you know, the head of Universal.
Wow. Very cool.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah, it is.
I mean, it's a whole story. I mean, I know as long as that was, I could have made it 10 times longer. But that was the end result of the whole thing. And I find the whole thing endlessly amusing, hilarious.
Well, I'd certainly like to speak with you more about this, and the stories are great and fascinating. So we'll have to do this again. And next time we'll talk about your studio, which I think is one of the top five in the world. It's just one of the best things. And we'll talk about the composer breakfast at another time as well.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Stay tuned for part two of my conversation with Richard Gibbs, where we talk about his awesome studio, which I really think is one of the top five in the world. To find out more about Richard, you can go to richardgibbs.com. That's Richard Gibbs, G-I-B-B-S, all one word, .com. Thanks for listening and being my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@BobbyOInnerCircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to BobbyOsinski.com and select the podcast tab, or you can go to BobbyOInnerCircle.com or find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At BobbyOsinski.com and BobbyOInnerCircle.com, you'll find a sign-in form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.